Did you know that the University of Central Missouri has been leading innovation for nearly 150 years? With more accreditations and more qualified faculty members, our commitment to academic success is unparalleled. And we make sure every student receives the support they need to graduate on time and with less debt. So whatever opportunity you're looking for, make your impact sooner at UCM, with campuses located in Warrensburg, Lee's Summit, and online. Find out more about UCM and the power of opportunity in action at ucmo.edu.
This is Voices of UCM, sponsored by Rise Community Services. Today, we sat down with Lynn Urban, the Chair of Criminal Justice and Criminology. We talk about the criminal justice programs at UCM, her research into parenting in prison, and her viewpoints on how the media portrays criminal justice. Hello, everyone. This is Voices of UCM. I'm your host, Andrew Zellner, and today I'm sitting down with the Chair of Criminology and Criminal Justice, Lynn Urban. How are you doing today, Lynn?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing good. End of the week. It's like we were talking about before the show, it's been going by really quickly.
Yes.
Surprisingly enough, I would have thought it would have been a slower week, but here we are at the end of Friday.
Yep, absolutely.
So you're the chair of the Criminal Justice and Criminology Department. How did you end up initially getting into that position?
Yeah, so Betsy Kreisel was the prior chair, and she moved up to the associate dean position in the Harmon College.
Yeah.
And so we, had to decide on some leadership changes, and there were some, various things that happened. But then in the fall of 2014, it landed on me, and I was able to take on that opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. And I believe you were a professor at the time. Is that right?
I was getting promoted to professor that year.
So it was basically the double promotion there almost.
It was.
Was that a lot to kind of unpack and deal with at the time?
So our promotion process, you really have to start in the spring or even earlier than that and submit all of your materials in September. So it's one of those, you submit your materials and they're gone and it's up to the process to work. So it was just the watching and waiting for that year for that. But
What about the year when you actually started doing stuff in those positions? Was that kind of hard to adjust to initially?
So when I started on campus?
When you were promoted to both chair and professor.
Right. So the professor part's easy, right? Because I had been doing that for 9 years.
You're in rank
for a certain amount of time, and then you get
promoted.
And then
you move up. Okay.
So moving from faculty to department chair, pretty big. Pretty big learning curve. So just everything from figuring out some of the history of the department, really understanding at a higher level how things operate. Because at the faculty level, you are very good at your classes, you're very good at interacting with students and knowing certain things that go on around campus. But moving up to that higher level is a different view.
I imagine it's a lot more work comparatively.
It's a lot different work, right? Absolutely more administrative, more, making sure things keep running versus interacting every day with students and teaching and doing scholarship and service and all that.
So it's definitely the different experience there. I imagine it's determining curriculum and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, so curriculum starts with the faculty, but it is also part of the department chair's purview to say, maybe we should look at this, maybe we should look at that. Or if the faculty come to you and say, we think we should look at this, just to help facilitate that process.
Yeah.
So a lot of being a chair is facilitating what the faculty want to do, what their goals are.
So what kind of programs does the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice offer to students?
Absolutely. We have a Bachelor of Science. We also have a Master of Science with two different areas. One is Theoretical Criminology, Criminal Justice and Criminology, and one is Administration and Leadership. Then on the undergraduate side, again, we have multiple minor certificates corrections minor, law enforcement minor, juvenile justice minor. We're having a brand new mental health certificate come out this fall. And then we also have a terrorism and homeland security certificate. And then cooperatively, we have the legal studies minor with political science and some other departments. And the juvenile justice minor and a lot of our certificates, they're interdisciplinary. There are other programs that the classes are involved, but it's collaborative, but it's just housed in our,
right,
our area.
Yeah. It's housed in the framework of criminal justice and stuff.
Yep.
So that I find that interesting how there's like the two like major like the two majors, and then there's like a bunch of minors. I found that interesting in terms of like how that would be taught, because I think it sounds like it allows like students to kind of specialize in like specific areas of it.
You're absolutely right. Yes. So we have about half of our students are interested in law enforcement. So they may very well go for that terrorism certificate, law enforcement minor, or some other minors or certificates across campus.
Right. Yeah.
But then that means half of our students are interested in something else. So that legal studies, juvenile justice, corrections, all of those different things. So, yeah, we pride ourselves on a very diverse curriculum, very diverse options. And then we're lucky enough to have faculty that are in each of those areas. So students get taught by somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's definitely important, I imagine, when you have a professor that actually knows what they're saying. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then one of the things I was looking at on the like the criminal justice like website page on UCM is that you have the, like that bachelor, like hybrid bachelor master's degree program.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So the accelerated program is you finish 90 hours at the undergraduate level. Actually, that's not right. So the accelerated program is where a student is just a regular undergraduate student. Then once they get up to a certain point, they can apply to the accelerated program.
Okay.
There are a specific number of classes that are cross-listed in the catalog to where if they take it as a graduate student, it will backfill into their bachelor's degree.
Oh,
so there are 12 hours that there's a point in there for about two semesters that they're taking both undergraduate and graduate classes.
Okay.
But it speeds things up. It
right,
lets
yeah.
them get both of those degrees in 5 years instead of six.
Yeah, that's, I mean, like speeding up by a whole year, that's probably huge because you get that like the dual credit there. And I imagine it also probably helps with like learning as well, because if you're doing just the one class, it's a lot easier to kind of keep it contained to that one class, where as opposed to if you had to take two separate, it'd be like, I'm either repeating some information potentially, or why wasn't this in this other class? So I think that makes more sense in terms of, I don't know what the exact phrasing is there, but like it makes more sense in my brain. How about?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's true that there are times that a student can dual enroll
right.
in both graduate and undergraduate classes. So they're not doing the full accelerated program, but maybe they're finished with all except one or two of their undergraduate classes, and they do want to keep going on to the graduate level.
Yeah.
So they just petition to be dual enrolled, so it's okay for them to take those few undergraduate and one or two graduate classes at the same time.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So in like the department, is there a lot of, I guess it would probably depend on the class and the minor and whichever thing you're talking about, but is there like some hands-on work involved with it?
Absolutely. I mean, we have probably the best example is where teachers flip the classroom. So I'll give you some homework that tells you about the definitions of something. You know, so you can go look those up on your own and talk about them. But then when you come to class, we will actually make some decisions. We'll talk about, okay, if this is the scenario, then if you were this kind of a, you, if you had this philosophy, what would you do? If you had that philosophy, what would you do? Some things like that.
Okay.
Right now I'm teaching Introduction to Juvenile Justice. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things is I give the students a scenario. I give them various pieces of paper, and they have to fill all of those out. So here's the information about the juvenile. What's their risk score? They have to go through and kind of find all that information and make that decision.
Right.
And then, okay, based on that risk score decision, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep them? Are you going to put them in detention? You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So those opportunities for them to be making those realistic decisions in class.
Right. And like having that highly interactive nature in class, I imagine, is also a lot more engaging for students.
Absolutely. It's always more fun to have a conversation.
Right.
A lot of our classes, mm-hmm. like crime, justice, and social diversity, that's our capstone uh-huh. class, very discussion-based. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Petkosic's criminology class, very mm. discussion-based. It's not, it's pretty rare that you have one of our professors who mm-hmm. is just talking at you. We have
right.
a lot of interaction because there's a lot of interesting things to talk about when it comes to criminal justice.
I mean, certainly there is, because there's so many, like, even with, like, the list of minors that we have, it's like, that doesn't even feel like that covers a lot of areas of it because it's such a vast field.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that is probably one of the myths. You know, people mm-hmm. say, oh, criminal justice, you're a police officer. No, that's not what I did.
No, yeah.
Exactly. So it's one of our jobs to mm-hmm. let everybody know about all of the different things that you can do.
Right, yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, like you said, when we talk about criminal justice, it's like, oh, yeah, police officer. But then you have to consider, like, even within police officer, even,
absolutely.
There's, like, so many different positions you could fill. But then you
yep.
also have every other position
yep.
that's in, like, the courts, that's
yep.
in
yep. law,
justice,
corrections,
law.
Yep,
mm-hmm.
so all of that, yep.
It's a lot of stuff to consider, I imagine,
yep.
when
Which
deciding,
is,
like, curriculum and stuff.
Yeah, it's great for us, though, because we, you know, a student can, you know, come to us and say, oh, I thought I wanted to do this, but now I'm not mm-hmm. so sure. And so then we can help them. Well, did you think about this? Did you think about that? Oh, I never thought about that.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, they don't have to change their major or, mm-hmm. or do anything like that, and they can keep going and find something that they
yeah.
love.
Because it is such a vast field that you can yep. – it feels like you can easily swap over, especially when you're young and coming into college, when you might
yep.
not know exactly what you want to do. So you can experiment a bit
yep.
in the classes. And
absolutely.
I think that's very valuable.
Yep. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we don't make students choose a specialty area
mm-hmm.
on paper. You know,
right,
we don't
yeah.
have specific options that they're locked into.
Mm-hmm.
So they can use their criminal justice electives. They can use a minor or certificate, mm-hmm. double major, you know,
right.
to do that for themselves. And so we don't lock them in. I always, you know, joke and tell students that you can change your mind walking across the stage at graduation that, nope, I'm going to be a probation and parole officer now. So it works out.
So does the department, like, connect students with people who are professionally working in the industry?
Absolutely.
Okay.
At the program level, one way we do that is every fall we have an alumni showcase.
Okay.
Which looks like a career fair, but it's
mm-hmm.
not really people who are recruiting.
It's more so showing off, like, achievements, it sounds
absolutely.
Like?
Absolutely. Okay. Their achievements or just what they do.
Mm.
For example, we had an alum who worked in Kansas City
mm-hmm.
as their crime analyst for the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't hire, but she came back and, you know, set up her table and chatted with everybody. And so many students now are, I think that's what I want to do. I think that's what
oh,
I
yeah.
want to, what do I want to be? So there's lots of times that students will come to this event and
yeah.
come away with, I didn't even know that was a job. Because I personally, every semester, an alum reaches out and I say, I didn't even know that was a job. So it's just a really great opportunity to do that.
Right.
And so that's at the program level. But even our student groups will constantly bring in professionals from the outside to chat with students, and that's a smaller
mm-hmm.
group, so they really feel like they get almost a one-on-one interaction.
Right, yeah.
And in our classes, we do it all the time as well. We bring in professionals,
mm-hmm.
and then if, you know, a student wants to have that experience, they can do an internship. And
right,
so
yeah.
there's all kinds of different ways that they can interact with those people who are out there and have the job that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll connect them with them. Another really cool thing that we do is our Alpha Phi Sigma student group.
All right.
Has a mentorship program.
Oh, okay.
And so they will pair a current student with a mentor, with a professional in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can be something as simple as grabbing coffee a couple times or a few phone calls. But
yeah, some simple stuff, yeah.
Absolutely. But it's just that connection so that they have somebody who's out there right now and can tell them, make sure you're doing this, make sure you're not doing that, to be able to be successful in the field.
Right, yeah, having that person who's actively working there so they can actively communicate, hey, here's what the market's looking like right now. Here's where you can potentially maybe get a job. Here's
yep.
what to do, what not to do. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And just the tricks, right? When
right,
you fill out
yeah.
your application, be sure you are addressing this or that or
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that.
Yeah. Maybe like some of the small, even like the small things that, like, you don't necessarily teach in, like, a class or something like that. It's like how you act around your superior or something
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. Yep, how to dress for an interview.
Right, yeah.
Because that's, you know, thanks
that's
COVID.
That's half the battle at this point, yeah.
Thanks COVID, now nobody knows what to wear, right?
Yeah. Everyone's on the Zoom call with nice top on and then shorts. So.
Exactly. So we do not want to wear that to an in-person interview.
Not ideal, yeah.
Right, right.
We'll be right back with more Voices of UCM. Brought to you by Rise Community Services.
That's the sound of a door slamming in your face. That's the sound heard by many individuals living with a disability. But it doesn't have to be. Rise Community Services is committed to opening doors, not closing them. We believe that each person deserves a life that is full of hope and empowered by self-choice. If you or a loved one need help, please visit watchusrise.org.
A degree in digital media production with an emphasis in sports communication will enhance your knowledge in multi-camera live sports productions, in addition to writing for sports media. Our faculty members bring real-world experience to the classroom, and students can showcase their work through different media outlets, including live streaming under the MIAA Network, UCMCTV, and digitalberg.com. For more information on this, please visit ucmo.edu/DMP.
Welcome back to Voices of UCM, brought to you by Rise Community Services. Today, we sat down with Lynn Urban, the Chair of Criminal Justice and Criminology. We continued our discussion by talking about what classes she teaches and her research involving parenting in prison.
So, as a professor, what kind of classes do you mostly teach?
So, as the department chair, I only get to teach one class per semester. Typically, in the fall, I teach our graduate planning class, so it's like criminal justice strategic planning.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite classes because talk about experiential learning. The students each pick an agency, and then that's the semester we go through the book, and at each step they are working with their agency to create that strategic plan.
Okay.
So it's my favorite class. Mm-hmm. But then the other one that I teach a lot is our introduction to juvenile justice.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which we were talking about.
Yep.
A bit earlier, yeah.
Yep.
And that's specifically for, like, juvenile justice, as it says, yeah?
Yes. So, I mean, it just talks about the origin of the system because it is completely separate from the adult system.
Yeah, definitely, because you have to treat children differently than adults because of a multitude of different factors.
Absolutely. But we get kids who do very, very bad things.
Obviously,
like
yeah, that
at
does
the
happen.
Chiefs rally.
Yeah, it wasn't
so
great.
What do we do with that? You know, you can't treat all children the same. But
right.
So that's part of the difficulty with that system.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's very hard to kind of figure out exactly what to do in that in some of those cases.
Yeah, there's guidelines and everything, but
right, yeah, but
it's still difficult.
Right, yeah, and it's definitely going to be on like a case-by-case basis.
And there's no one magic thing.
Right, yeah.
We like nice, simple solutions, and you really do have to just treat each child individually.
Right, yeah. And I think that's almost general for all of, like, criminal justice, that, like, every case is going to be different in some form or fashion from the last. Even if they are similar crimes, it's like, well, there's a multitude of different factors that weren't even a factor in this other case, so
exactly.
You have to treat every case with a different thing. And I feel like, especially in, like, the media and stuff, and general media, and then, like, the news media as well, it's, like, it's all boiled down a lot.
Yes. Yeah, we like I said, we like to put things in very simplistic terms, but sometimes it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if we do have very rigid rules, then that's unfair.
Right.
But then if we have no rules, then that's unfair, because then things get decided by, you know, race or gender, and then
right.
those things,
then
that's not fair either.
That's not fair, yeah.
So it's mm-hmm. it's a tough thing.
It's yeah, I imagine it's very. It's hard to quantify and qualify all of the different things that lead up to a conviction.
Yes. And then you have the, you know, one of the wrinkles is this the first time you've gotten into trouble, whether you're an adult or a juvenile?
Right, yeah.
Or is this the 19th time you've gotten in trouble?
And then that
what
completely
else
changes the
on?
Dynamic of everything, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, do we treat everybody the same? Is that fair? And, you know, first time, not first time, and what can we do instead of something that's very harsh? And so there's lots of different philosophies out there.
Definitely, yeah.
But I think, you know, those people working in the field and us who are training people to get out there into the field, I think we're all doing our best as to provide, we provide our students with that variety.
Right.
As far as you're going to get out there in the field and you're going to meet people who have this philosophy and see things this way. You're also mm-hmm. going to get out there and meet people with this philosophy who see things this way. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter what you think, you know, I mean, you're going to have to fit in there mm-hmm. Along with those people. So it's just to recognize that definitely in criminal justice and juvenile justice, there's many different ways to think about the problem.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
That's just one of the things we do is to help them see all of those different ways and then figure out what their way is as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm, for sure. So how did you end up studying criminal justice?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting route. My right. bachelor's degree is anthropology. Mm-hmm. I am an archaeologist.
Oh, yeah.
So when I was kind of transitioning, I had graduated. It had been a couple of years. I took some years off mm-hmm. and thought to myself, well, what was the most interesting class that you had ever taken as an undergrad, the one that you did all the reading, did the recommended reading, did extra mm-hmm. studying. And the class that I absolutely loved was physical anthropology, where we identified human bones.
Mm.
So way before CSI, I thought to myself, I could be a crime scene investigator.
Mm-hmm.
So by that point in my life, I already had kids and established household and all of that.
Oh, right.
So I wasn't able to go to, insert faraway college here.
Mm-hmm.
So I started attending the University of Missouri at St. Louis mm-hmm. As a master's student, uh-huh. just knowing that I needed that master's degree really to move on. Not really sure
right, yeah.
what my vision was. I am one of those people that kind of just barrels through life. Not recommended, but it's worked out for me okay, I think.
Uh-huh.
And so started there and completed that master's degree. I was almost finished, and one of my mentors asked me, what are you doing? And I said, well, looking for a job, but it's not cooperating. Mm. And he said, why don't you join the PhD program, which was secretly a goal, a desire of mine. Mm-hmm. But, if you apply and get rejected, then that's terrible. So but once he kind of said, well, why don't you do that?
And try it out. It's like when you're getting nudged by someone, it's like, okay, well, maybe I should then.
Yep, absolutely. So I did. And, a lot of hard work later, here I am.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yep.
Very cool. Yeah. So I was looking at like your personal page on mm-hmm. the like the UCM website, mm-hmm. and I was looking at your research interests in
yes.
particular. which was parenting from prison and human trafficking. Do you
yes.
want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. The parenting from prison is many years ago, like 2010.
Oh, yeah.
The executive director of PATCH, which is Parents and Their Children.
Mm-hmm.
Contacted me because they were writing a grant, and all grants now have an evaluation component.
Uh-huh.
And her name's Barb Burton, and mm-hmm. the program is out of Chillicothe Correctional Center for Women here
okay.
in Missouri. And the program is where women take parenting classes, and then when they take those classes, when they're successful and do everything they're supposed to, no violations,
right.
they get a special visit with their children.
Oh, okay.
And so their children can be anywhere from newborns to 18.
Mm.
And the room is completely different. A normal, regular meeting room, visitation mm-hmm. room for prison is pretty stark, kind of a cafeteria looking tables.
Right, yeah.
You have to keep your hands on the table, no hugging, things
mm-hmm.
like that. In a PATCH room, there's toys, there's rocking chairs, you can sit and read books, you can play on the floor, mm-hmm. they are allowed to hug. They're observed the whole time,
Right, yeah.
So they're not left alone. They get to have lunch together mm-hmm. and they get a photo snapped of themselves and
oh, okay.
A copy goes to mom and a copy goes home with the child.
Uh-huh.
So we have shown through this evaluation, mm-hmm. we evaluated it for 10 years and then
oh,
finally
wow.
our grant ran out.
Mm.
And we've shown that significantly every year, the women who participated learned something in these classes.
Okay.
And there was even some evidence that women who, did it year one kept some of that knowledge into year two.
Mm.
And the purpose, the grant that we received was from the Children's Trust Fund.
Okay.
And so one of their missions is preventing child abuse and neglect.
Right.
And so it's not a direct path, but women who have better parenting skills are less likely than to have issues with child abuse and neglect.
Right, yeah.
So that's where that interest came out of, and I'm pretty excited because we're applying for another grant, and so we might be able, to keep that going. Yes, because Patch is a nonprofit, so they rely on volunteers and donations and things like that. But very, very valuable, in my opinion. And my research throughout my career has been very practical, very like program evaluation. Does this work? Kind of things.
Yeah.
That's just my leaning. I'm very interested to know if programs work or things like that. So very, very happy to be associated with Patch.
Mm-hmm. So in that research, did you find like that they're like the prisoners' like mental states were better as well, that they were able to go through these classes and then see their children as well?
We didn't measure anything like that, but you can tell when you are interacting with the moms and you know, some of it is it actually went the other way. They learned how a quote unquote good mom acts, and then they look at their own behavior and think, wow, I wasn't being a very good mom. But they have support groups and things like that, and of course it's not, yep, you're a terrible mom,
but then even still having that reflection, though, that's really like the first huge step, because after you get past that, then I imagine it's a lot easier to keep climbing from there.
Yes.
As opposed to completely shutting them off, right?
Right, right. And we, of course, so the women have 10 classes. This lasts a long time.
Right.
So they have a lot of interaction.
Yeah, it takes a while.
And do, like I said, support groups where they get to talk about, you know, okay, we had a visit last week. How did it go? And, you know, so for some moms, it's great. It was wonderful. You know, I got to use these techniques and everything's great. And for others, it was, I knew, like, multiple choice what I was supposed to do, and then we got in the room, and it was very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or just some of the moms coming to grips with what their children are going through.
Right.
Because the biggest thing for children is that they feel like their mom abandoned them.
Mm-hmm.
They feel very isolated, even though they have family or, you know, people who are caring for them.
But
some of them, we have a lot of quotes from moms and kids. And, you know, a lot of them revolve around, I had to, you know, come to grips with how angry he is with me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but then that's what the visits are for. They're in those more secluded visits or, you know, more personal.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they can really talk about those things.
Yeah.
You know, a woman with a young child is they're very excited to just play blocks and things like that. And that can look very productive, redirecting a child's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the most impactful visits for moms are the ones with their teenage kids where they just sit and talk about the hard stuff.
Right, yeah. Because, I mean, I can't imagine, like, the dynamics that might even come up there.
Yep.
Because it's a very complicated thing to occur.
Yes. Yep. And, yeah, just the difficulties of knowing that you've missed birthdays. And one question we would ask is, what is something new that you learned about your child? And, you know, sometimes it's, they've learned to tie their shoes. They've learned to, you know, just things that...
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, some parents take for granted.
It's these small, like, innocuous things that are like, well, maybe that wouldn't be a big deal if I was out in the world and like, oh, yeah, you learn how to tie your shoe. But, like, when you're not seeing them, it's like, oh, my goodness, you've changed so much.
Yep.
It's like these big moments.
Yep. But, yeah, I'm really excited because the program does seem to have some effect also with once the women are released, then their recidivism, their reoffending rates out in the community are lower.
Okay.
So that's what we're all, that's what most criminal justice programs are about, is to stop that reoffending.
Is that we want to stop the reoffending, we want to rehabilitate, it seems like that's what it's more shifting to rather than pure punishment. It seems like there's still that slow shift to rehabilitation.
Yes, we tend to pendulum swing. You know,
yeah.
One decade we'll talk about rehabilitation. One decade we'll talk about punishment. So there's a happy medium in there. And like we talked about before, you know, there are some people that punishment is the appropriate outcome for them.
Yeah.
So we just have to take it one by one.
You have to take it case by case. Yeah, like we were saying.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think we can, like, raise awareness for specifically, like, parenting from prison? Because that's an issue that's, like, not really covered a lot in, like, the general talk among people.
Yeah. Well, like I said, our grant funder is the Children's Trust Fund.
Right.
And they have enormous amounts of resources as far mm-hmm. as preventing abuse and neglect and things like that. So they're definitely a way, kind of through them, we can spread that information. Patch has a website and patchofchillicothe.org, maybe.com. It spreads that way. Most of it is in the classroom every day. We teach our students that, a person in prison is a person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what our goals are and this is what our aims are. And and it is to help them see all of these different programs that might be out there. So, you know, there are parenting from prison programs. There are there are ones for dads in prison. You know, this one is just in a women's prison.
It just happens to be for
specifically
women.
Yeah. There's all kinds of, you know, vocational rehabilitation programs. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things like that. You know, so that's one of the things that we teach our students that this is how we can hopefully keep them from reoffending. It's not that we're putting them in prison and praying or hoping.
Right.
It's that we're actually, you know, what are we actually doing to try to get that to happen?
Stay tuned for more after this break. Voices of UCM is sponsored by Rise Community Services.
Every minute, there are 6 children born in the U.S., and one of them will be born with a developmental disability. RISE Community Services believes that an individual's potential doesn't vanish simply because they were born with a unique set of challenges. We believe that each person deserves a life full of hope and empowered by self-choice. If you or a loved one need help, please visit watchusrise.org.
A degree in digital media production with an emphasis in audio will enhance your skill set for work in radio, television, film, and beyond. Our faculty members bring real-world experience to the classroom, and students can showcase their work on UCM Radio The Beat, as well as in film projects and live events. For more information on this or other concentrations within the Digital Media Production Program, please visit ucmo.edu/DMP.
You're listening to Voices of UCM, sponsored by RISE Community Services. Today, we sat down with Lynn Urban, the Chair of Criminal Justice and Criminology. We finish our talk by discussing the media's portrayal of criminal justice.
So how do you feel about, this is kind of a more, maybe a more fun question a little bit. How do you generally feel about, like, the portrayal of criminal justice in, like, in our media?
Oh, like, absolutely.
And I kind of want to separate this into, like, news media and then, like, fictional media, like TV shows, movies, all that stuff.
Right. So I'll start with the news media first.
Mm-hmm. And that could even, like, include maybe, like, true crime even.
Okay.
When discussing, because that is nonfiction media.
Okay.
We'll separate it into those,
too. Yeah. So I remember distinctly it was the Ferguson issue.
Right.
And I just distinctly remember when I would read or listen to media accounts, whoever it was would talk. Mm-hmm. And I would do the hand motion, like the more. It's like, okay, now say the rest of it. And then I'd hear somebody from the other side. And I, again, more. Finish the sentence. So what I would tell people, because people will stop you on the street and, you know, oh, what do you think about this, you know, big criminal justice issue?
Right, yeah.
I would say that both sides of the media did a very good job of telling half the story. And that's usually my take on everything. I just
generally,
really distinctly remember with the Ferguson issue that was the case. And so personally, yes, I am a person who watches all of those terrible shows, right? Which they're not terrible. So, you know, I watch the NCIS, I watch the CSIs and all of that. But it's fun actually to watch them and say, that's not quite right.
Right, yeah.
And it's also good to be able to tell students. So if you take this show, this piece is true. if you take this show, this piece is true. They all, again, tend to get it about half right.
Right,
so
yeah.
A lot of times they give one person too many jobs.
Mm.
Because I understand.
I mean, you have to streamline some things for fictional stories, especially for like TV where you only have like 45 minutes to an hour of time per episode. You got to streamline it a little bit.
And
so that's a bit more.
You can't have 14 actors, right? We've got to stick with the four
just
that
like,
we have.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I like the nonfiction or the fiction. I like the fiction because it's also one of the ways that people do know anything at all about the criminal justice system.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like a starting point. It's a common ground, you know. And you can ask students, "Whoa, what are you watching? Or what's something that you've seen on TV that you want to know whether it's true or not?"
Uh-huh.
And that's a very good conversation starter, especially you know, for a CJ 1000 intro class or something like that.
Well, yeah, because if they're just coming in, it's like, "Oh yeah, have you seen this on TV? Well, here's the actual application in the real world, and this is kind of how it works, and this is what TV gets right, TV gets wrong."
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually they make things seem really, really more exciting than they actually are. Yes.
Again, to spice it up a bit for the audience, right?
I will say, I'm, you know, a shameless plugger. I mean, it's not even shameless. I don't know any of them. But the On Patrol live show where they follow the police departments around.
Oh, right,
It was called something else before. That is pretty realistic, and there's a reason that they have to have like 8 or 9 departments, because there will literally be officers just driving around, or they can't find the address, or, you know. And so, yes, if you would just follow one of them, it would be not super exciting.
Especially if you're following them consistently, where it's just like they're driving for 40 minutes, they pull one dude over for a traffic violation or something, and then that's the episode.
Yes.
Like, that wouldn't be interesting to watch.
Exactly. So, but it's pretty realistic as far as these are what you're interactions are actually going to look like.
Right, yeah.
There's very little, you know, chasing down a bad guy and knocking in doors.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of public interaction.
Right, yeah, definitely.
Yep.
Because, like we were saying, it's just, you got to kind of glorify and make it interesting for an audience, especially if it's a fictional show like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, even like when, like, you only really hear, like, about the really big cases in, like, the news media and stuff, where you have, like, these big overarching cases that will affect either, like, a whole state or the whole country, even.
Right.
Or, like, a big scandal case, like a big murder case or something like that.
Yes.
But you don't hear about, like, the small claims court stuff.
Exactly. You know, somebody stole my bike off my front porch.
Right,
You rarely hear about those.
Because that's not, it's not newsworthy, right?
Right, yep. It is for you. But
I mean, like, well, yeah, if my bike got stolen, yeah, that's definitely newsworthy for me. I want my my bike back, please.
Yes. Yep. No, you're absolutely correct that it's the really big or celebrity cases
because
we all hear about, because it's, again, it's a common denominator. Did you hear what they did?
Mm-hmm. And it rakes in money as well. So that's what it's really all about at the end of the day. And kind of going off of that idea of, like, I don't know if exploitation is the right word, but specifically looking at, like, true crime, how do you feel how the media represents some of those cases, especially in, like, the nonfiction, like, documentary series?
Right.
Like,
yeah, I don't watch myself a lot of those.
Okay.
One thing that anybody who watches those should kind of watch out for is the victim perspective, especially when you're talking about a homicide or something like that. We do tend to glorify the offender in those kinds of situations. And I don't want to say forget about the victim, but forget about, you know, they sometimes
in
they
essence,
don't get.
Forgetting about them.
Sometimes they do not get the attention that they perhaps deserve.
Right.
It's definitely gotten a lot better in recent years.
Certainly.
Unfortunately, you know, some frequently for school shootings or mass shootings, there will be news outlets that refuse to publish the suspect's name.
Right.
And they will only publish the names of the victims.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just something to watch out for, and probably something, if you were interested in that kind of thing, to look at some very old documentaries versus some of the newer ones and see how that balance has perhaps shifted.
The comparison there, because I've noticed, like, there's like that, there was like the huge explosion of it, like, around, like, I don't know, like 10 years ago probably at this point, and then seeing it kind of evolve and then get talked about a lot more in terms of, like, oh, well, we maybe should stop glorifying these people who have done these horrible things.
Yeah.
It's been a very interesting It's an interesting thing to see develop over time.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me see. I believe I have one more thing. Where's that at? That's what it was, yeah. I was, again, going back to looking at, I believe I was looking at your LinkedIn, and I noticed that you were also the interim dean for a little bit, I believe?
I was. So for Harmon College, when Jose Mercado left the university, Betsy Kreisel, the associate dean, moved into the interim dean position, and so while we were searching for that dean position, she just needed some help. So myself and Matt Houseworth were both assistant deans. I took a few responsibilities. Dr. Houseworth took a few responsibilities, and we just helped her out for a semester.
Okay.
Mostly my job was kind of communication flow.
Okay.
Going to particular meetings, for example, with admissions and advising, and then making sure that information got distributed to the college.
Okay.
Another thing that I was responsible for was our newsletter, which is, again, communication, what's going on in the dean suite, going on around the college, so that we can share that with our colleagues. It was very interesting because, to get that up a little bit, higher level position and see how things operate on that level.
Right.
And to see that responsibility of the communication that comes out of the dean's office for any college on campus.
Right, yeah, because I mean that's I imagine it's a big vital area because you're directly communicating between the people who are teaching, running every college, and then
faculty and chairs, and the upper administration.
Yes, that would be the way to put that.
Yep,
yeah, I couldn't think of the word for a second there.
Yep. Yes, the upper administration, and then then filtering it up and down.
Right. Yeah.
Between faculty, chairs, and everybody else. Yep. And staff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Definitely, and factoring in all those ideas and then figuring out how to communicate those. I imagine that was how difficult did that end up being? Trying to collect all the information together.
We have a process for collecting information, like to go into the newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it was, like I said, you go to a meeting and you understand that this meeting, this is the content.
Okay.
And so then it's your responsibility to go and distribute that back out.
Okay.
But yeah, it's very true that the chair level, the dean level, it's information flows both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some things that we were, we pushed down to departments and programs, and then there's other times that there's very important things that are going on in programs, departments, that come up to the chair, go up to the dean, and then need to go up even higher. So it's definitely a very integral part of the communication flow.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yep.
All right. I think that's about where I'd like to wrap up. So
all right.
I appreciate you coming on. It's always a joy talking to people in general, I guess.
I appreciate the invitation. Mm-hmm. So I've never had a radio interview before, looking forward to hearing it.
This has been Voices of UCM, sponsored by Rise Community Services. Be sure to tune in next week at 7 p.m. on both Wednesday and Saturday. You can listen to the show at ucmbeat.com on either the live feed or at any time by going to the Shows tab and finding the Voices of UCM tab. Once again, I'm your host, Andrew Zellner, and we'll talk next time on Voices of UCM.